Welcome to the Rearview Mirror Podcast, looking back on all that we don't know and a few things that we do.
How was your weekend?
It was fantastic. Big birthday party for our daughter, and had all these goofy scavenger hunt and other kind of games for the adult kids as well as the grandkids. It was a zoo at my house, but it was so much fun.
Yeah. We saw you. My wife was envious that she's not part of that group. She said, I really want to be in that family.
It was hilarious.
I said, they'll probably take you in. I don't think they would know if somebody else showed up.
It was hilarious. Sarah chose the theme for her party. She wanted to do something with a hunting kind of motif or whatever. So she's asking for a dress in camo. And I thought, half my family didn't own camo. Somehow they all found camo. And it was hilarious because, you know, it's not deer season right now. And yet I've got my entire family running the neighborhood running around all this camo, and I'm thinking somebody called 911. I'm sure it was on our Sullivan Farms Facebook page had I looked at it, more than likely, but they had a blast. It was a cool way to celebrate her.
My first thought was, well, the trailer park people got the date on Halloween wrong, and they're running around trying to get candy in our neighborhood. Well, and then I realized it's not the trailer park people. Yeah, it's the Helton clan.
I'm from East Tennessee, so it's pretty close to trailer park.
I know.
Park.
We're not. Yeah, we're not far apart.
You know that. Yeah. It was fun, though. What did you do this weekend?
It was a fairly uneventful weekend, I think. I was traveling last week.
Mm. I heard about a place you went in this cold wintertime. How was that
trip? I went to Minnesota, Jeff. This was not a mandatory January trip. I could have picked any time in the past year to go on this trip.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you chose well.
I did. I think I did. It was 4 degrees when we got there. Gosh. It was -7 one morning when we woke up. And I had this debate. It was only a 2-day trip, and I've got this little duffel bag I could travel with.
Yeah.
And so I'm looking at Jen. I've got this big, heavy coat that my brother-in-law gave me, and I bet it weighs like 15 pounds. I mean, the thing is just, it's gigantic.
Massive.
It's a ski jacket. Like, got jackets inside of jackets. And I thought, I don't want to take that, you know, because really, I mean, how often are you outside?
Right.
You go from building the airport to the rental car, hotel to car, car to hotel, car to rental. I mean, it's 10 seconds, 15 seconds.
Right.
You know, how cold could it be?
Pretty?
Well, the first night, we got out of the rental car and walked to the restaurant across the street in a little downtown area. And I didn't know this about Minnesota, but it's flat.
Yeah.
And so when the wind blows, it
doesn't stop.
Was biting.
Yeah.
That's as cold as I've ever been.
Yeah.
So good call on taking the big heavy coat.
I'm so glad. Yeah.
Then got back. Our kids over last night, watched a little football, cooked some dinner.
Fun.
Smoked pork butt yesterday.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Good.
It was good. So fairly uneventful. It made me think about something last night, though. We had, my son's 25, daughter-in-law's 24, about to be 25. My other daughter's 22, about to be 23. I think I got all that right.
Good
and
job.
I was thinking about our topic last time.
Mm.
The messiness, ugliness sometimes, spirituality,
right.
Good and bad.
Yeah.
But we talked a lot about it in the context of how you and I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
Fire and brimstone, legalism, right. All that stuff.
So much of that, right?
But I wonder, what's it like to grow up in the spiritual world if you're in your 20s, early 30s today?
Yeah.
What do you think what are the challenges for that demographic?
Yeah. Wow. That's a great question.
Thanks.
Yeah. It feels like since we were kids, let me create that bigger context that gets to this generation. You know, so much that has changed, I think, is a sense of any kind of absolute truth. You know, we've become, of course, the word's been used for 30 years now, but about relativism and how truth is subjective. You know, I feel like that's the culture that our kids were raised in, is a culture where there were not nearly as many black and whites, maybe in a good way. You know, we talk about black and whites in two ways, the really negative thinking part of it. But there also are some things that are good, some things that are bad, some things that are right, some things that are wrong. And so it feels like with so much subjectivity that our kids were raised around, I mean, I see it frequently in that generation, just the sense of going, well, I don't know. I mean, I know that that's what you think is truth, but here's what I think is truth. And so there's a big subjectivity component to it. And at least that's what I think off the top of my head. You know, I feel like I see that a lot, where truth is relative to my experience, and it's almost like they become equal. Like you know, I mean, I think to put it crassly, when I was growing up, you know, we would talk about a book, the Bible, saying, gosh, well, if there's truth in there, then that truth really needs to guide my life. And now I think while there's still a lot of people that would embrace that, I think there's also a generation that's come behind us just going, well, yeah, but truth is really in what I experience, or kind of what I assume or kind of what I figure out. There's truth found there as well. And so I think that's some of it. I don't know. What about you? What do you think on that? What it's like to be that age growing up now?
I don't know. It's just interesting to hear their conversations and the things that are important to them, the things that motivate them. I don't think they're as dogmatic a generation as we were. We kind of knew what we thought was right, whether it was right or not. You know, it's like, as my dad used to say, off and wrong, but never in doubt. You know,
that's a great line.
He said that about me, so I think that's probably true. But not as much dogmatism, and some of that's good.
That's refreshing at one level, absolutely.
I don't know. I just think they've got a different set of challenges. I just felt like when I, you know, listening to them in the last couple of conversations we've had at dinner, I don't think legalism's a thing for them.
I agree.
Yeah. And so I'm just wondering what their thing is.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I don't know if I can name it, but I think you're onto something. Yeah.
Yeah. It was like relativism is part of it. But I think there's also a, man, there's a refreshing part of the way they view the world. More compassion, I think. A little more, you know, boy, you're walking on eggshells if you use this word, a little more tolerance.
Right.
But I think tolerance just means, for them, or some anyway, just putting yourself in another person's shoes.
Right. No, I think if I had to err on a continuum, the continuum I grew up in, which we talked so much about, you know, justice and holiness and the right thing versus a continuum of love, and I'll use your word, tolerance and acceptance, I would much rather err on the side this generation's erring on. You know, just I do think foundationally that what I want to be about is love people wherever they are. So I think there is something that's good on that. I think one of the trends I'm seeing, are you seeing this, you know, and I just don't know how much, maybe it's because part of what I see in my office, but this whole deconstruction concept that we've talked about the last decade or so, people who are deconstructing from their faith. Have you heard much about that? And what are your thoughts on that?
I hear it from time to time, and I've heard different I've heard different views on that, and some different interpretations on it. It's an interesting concept because I think in a way it's what you and I are doing. That's why we're doing this podcast.
Right.
Is the again, we said this in one of the first couple of episodes. I'm wondering what it is that I believe that I. What it is that I believed when I was 25 that I probably don't believe at 58.
Right.
And so, you know, deconstructing that, kind of walking it back a little bit, trying to figure out what I really do believe now.
Yeah.
And it's different. It stands to reason. I was having this conversation with somebody the other day. If Genesis 3 is true and we're all flawed, then it's reasonable to think our thinking is flawed.
Right.
And so there's probably something that we believe in strongly right now that's incorrect.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. My brother-in-law will often say that deconstruction is probably very necessary. It's really important to be able just to pause and look and say, hey, what am I believing that's not good? What am I believing that's not helpful? You know, there's some all sorts of things, idols even at one extreme, maybe of stuff that we'll believe in times that we need to go, oh, I need to deconstruct that. I need to tear that down. But his phrase that he uses a lot is this: deconstruction without reconstruction leads to destruction. It kind of cheesy, but I love it because I think about that.
Yeah.
I say we're getting ready to remodel a kitchen. We've been getting ready for a year, but at some point.
Same kitchen, same house?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you talked about that a bit.
Yeah. I think I started in 79 talking about it. No, Miss Laura and I are going to get that trigger pulled sooner or later. But, you know, I realize there will be some deconstruction. There'll be a lot of stuff ripped out, torn out, and thrown away. But at some point, there also has to be some vision for how are we going to reconstruct it? What are we going to build back? And I know faith isn't that logical as a kitchen remodel, but there is something to be said about it. If all we do is tear everything out and then try to live in that, I think that's kind of miserable. So I think there is something to be said about why am I deconstructing? Well, I want to deconstruct when I need to be able to go, gosh, where is there truth? Where does it that I need to understand something more clearly than I currently do.
Do the folks that come into your office know they're deconstructing?
That's a great question. Probably not. I mean,
guide them through that, or tell me how you approach that when you. Do they say something that triggers that in your mind and you take them through the deconstruction? Do they know they're coming in there without agenda or what's going on?
Well, there's a whole continuum, right? I mean, there are people who are coming in, they're using that language, and I'm just deconstructing and I need a safe place to process. And I'm thrilled. I want to be a safe place. And, man, I don't care what you want to talk about. And my goal as I sit in my chair is not to make them believe what I believe. My goal is to make sure they've got a safe place to process where they are. And then, you know, when they want feedback, I love to offer feedback. I love to offer some sense of guidance. But, you know, I'm not in that mode of, oh, gosh, you've got to see it the same way I see it. I want to listen to where they are. I've just discovered that when people have a space to really process, and if they're serious about doing the hard work of trying to think through, well, why am I thinking what I'm thinking, or why am I doing what I'm doing, I think they usually get to some, with very little guidance, I think they usually find a place where they feel a sense of confidence in what I believe, hopefully, is truth. I think there are other people, though, who show up, and they really are, they don't know what's going on, but they're just kind of, gosh, life used to always work this way, and now it's not working that way. I think that's a form of deconstruction, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's a place where I'm honored to get to help people pause and just say, well, tell me about how it worked so well. Why did it work so well? Well, why do you think it's not working well now? Because as we've talked about previously, you know, I think there's some things that don't work as well as we get older as they did work when we were younger. And I just think it's how I think we all adapt as we get more knowledge, as we get more experience, as we grow, as we understand, change is inevitable. Mm. Someone once said, you know, our culture eats change for breakfast, but most of us try to ignore any change, and yet it needs to happen for
us. It's the one constant.
It is, absolutely. You know? Yeah.
Yeah, I think I'm wondering when you say that. So how do you take someone through a deconstruction process?
Process makes it sound so formal.
Better word, how do you prompt them towards investigating their deconstruction?
Yeah, yeah. You know, that's a great question. I think that a lot of what happens is just making space to really talk about why are they disappointed with what they believed, with what they thought. And, you know, we kind of started this question talking about our faith backgrounds and the faith deconstruction, and that certainly is, you know, a massive important topic. But I think there are a lot of people who come in, and the question is not even about faith. It's just about how could I have loved her so much for so long, and why am I not feeling those same feelings of love now? You know, I've fallen out of love with my person, you know?
Yeah.
That's the category of deconstructing. They're trying to figure out what's happened to me. And I think, unfortunately, if our only thing to process is just the emotion of it, then I think a lot of people will just go ahead and say, well, I'm checking out, whether it's faith, whether it's a marriage, or whatever. I think part of the healthy deconstructing is being able to experience the emotions, feel the emotions, talk about the emotions, but to realize the emotions are more of a dashboard on the car. They're not the actual engine of the car. You know, the little flashing lights on the dashboard, they don't make the car run. They just tell you what's going on down in the engine.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of what I want to do is give them space to get the emotion out, to feel it, but try to understand then what do they really know? What do they really want? What is they desire?
What's true?
Yeah. And that at some level has to transcend the emotion of the moment. That is there a place where they go back to truth? So in marriage, just use that for example. I think what I love, and I get to see this from time to time, it's when someone comes in that place of I'm falling out of love, I don't feel what I used to feel, and as we make space to process the emotion of it, as we go back and do some remembering, I think that's part of it too, is remembering, well, why did you get married? Tell me about your relationship. Tell me about how y'all developed. Well, what happened that shifted things?
Right.
Because there's usually a few things, or sometimes a lot of things over a lot of years. But sometimes I think it's in the remembering where people stop and go, you know, there was a commitment I made, and the kind of person I want to be is I want to be a person of my commitment. But I And I want more. How do we get that? And then that often leads to the beginning of, gosh, we need to change how we're doing what we're doing right now. But again, I think it is trying to make the space to feel the feelings, but then to get to the truth too of, okay, but what's the truth that you want to hold? What's the caliber of man, the caliber of a woman that you want to be? How do you want to walk, navigate this season?
Do you find that, and I'm asking your questions because you're really good at evaluating this. Well, do you find that people have a difficult time pinpointing disappointments or acknowledging disappointments?
Yeah, I think.
And why is that?
Yeah.
I do sometimes too.
Yeah. I think most of us struggle with being okay being sad. You know, sad feels so futile. You know, why would I want to be sad? That doesn't do anything for me.
It's not productive.
Exactly. And we are a production-oriented world, for
no
sure.
Doubt.
And so sadness feels counterintuitive, doesn't feel helpful. And yet the paradox is, it's through sadness that you get to joy. You know, it's funny. It's there's a few counselors and social scientists who've written books, and they talk about that concept. But that's really was written by some Old Testament people 4,000 or 5,000 years ago. You know, one of the Psalms says that there may be a season of weeping and grieving, but following it always comes joy. I think the words say something like, weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning. That's not necessarily an 8-hour window of a flip-flop there.
Yeah,
but
right.
But there really is a great principle in that, is that grieving and sorrow, sadness, are precursors to experiencing the life we really want to. But I think, to your question, I think most of us are either A, afraid that if I start grieving, I'm going to get caught down in a rabbit hole that I'll never be able to get out of, and I'll be sad forever, and then I'll be depressed, you know? Or B, I think for a lot of us, we don't even know what it means to be sad. We don't even know what it means to grieve, because, again, no one's really modeled a sense of how do I navigate disappointment well. That's what I see a lot, Steve.
I think, before we started the podcast today, we were talking about some different things and some disappointing things that both of us have had happen in the last few months or years, and the incongruity seemingly of the Psalms.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was telling you about this little verse I read in Psalm 34 where David says, in my desperation I prayed and the Lord heard me. He saved me from all my troubles. I don't feel like that's the case right now.
Yeah.
I feel like in my desperation, I've prayed, and the Lord has not saved me from all my troubles.
Right.
Yet.
Yeah.
And so intuitively, you know, man, it doesn't mean that it's right now.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that it's an immediate rescue.
Yeah.
But it also doesn't mean that it doesn't hear us.
Right. I think that's probably one of my pet peeves.
Here we go. Now we're going to get into some good stuff. Let's go.
No, I grew up in that background that said, you know, it's what some people would call like prosperity gospel, right? I grew up in that background that if you pray and you ask for it, God will give it to you. So for me, I was a courageous young boy. You know, I'd ask for big things, and then rarely did those things come to me.
Right.
And so it created this sense of, well, wait a minute. I thought if you ask God, he would give it to you. And I think that's one of my pet peeves, is that sometimes we don't know how to read the Psalms. We don't know how to read the Psalms. We don't know how to listen to songs. I mean, this happens to me all the time, where I get hooked on a certain lyric in a song, and I'm like, okay, what idiot wrote that? No disrespect to our songwriting friends. But I'm just like, that's simply not true. That's terrible theology.
Right.
And then sometimes I'll reflect on the words, and I'll go, oh, wait, I think David said that in the Psalms, didn't he?
Yeah.
So maybe it's not bad theology.
Right.
But I think it's how we define a phrase and understand that it's not always just defined through our worldview only. In our family, if there is a hymn of the faith that's kind of our family anthem, we don't have one. If it was, it would be the old hymn, Great is Thy Faithfulness, been around forever. And there's this line, and it says, all I have needed your hand has provided. Well, you know, if you don't understand a little bit of theology behind that, then I think what you begin to think is, well, I need a new car, so God, you need to provide it. You know,
yeah. Provided it.
Yes, exactly. Instead of realizing, no, what does it mean, all I have needed? Well, I think part of acknowledging my needs is acknowledging that I don't even fully know my need, but there is one greater than me. So that's why when I pray and I ask for something and I get something else, it's not that my prayer wasn't answered. It was that it was answered in a way that is actually what I need and not just what I want or just desire. But in moments of pain, in moments of disappointment, that sucks. That's not fun.
Yeah.
You know, I'm praying for a big deal to close and it doesn't close.
Right.
Well, what do I feel? I feel like, God, why didn't you hear my prayer? Well, maybe he did.
Yeah.
But maybe the answer wasn't congruent with what I longed for. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I always think about this, and I don't know. I mean, I'd be open to talking about this. One of the things that I think I'm good at in my work world is getting to the root of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
But I always think the root of the problem spiritually is how do I wrestle with if I am disappointed, okay, or something difficult has happened. I mean, ultimately, it all goes back to God.
Yeah.
He could have changed it.
Yep.
But he didn't.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what do you do with that?
Yeah. Yeah.
And could I, usually part B of that is then I flip to the human side. Hey, could I have done something different?
Yeah.
Yep. Or am I to blame for that? Mm-hmm. Is somebody else to blame for that? Mm-hmm. Is he? But he could have, I guess all that's trumped by he could have changed it and he didn't.
Mm-hmm. So put you on the spot.
Yeah.
So when that happens in your story, when there's something that you really want and it doesn't go that way that you thought it should, could
right.
have gone, and you realize, God, you could have made that happen and you didn't, what do you do with that?
That's a good question there. I think I tend to feel the emotion of it.
Mm.
I feel shame. I usually go to shame.
Yeah.
You know, like, hey, I'm just not good enough. I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
There's a flaw.
Mm-hmm.
And what did I do wrong? What did I, you know? And I wear it, bear that burden. Yeah, I think that's accurate. I don't know. I'd be interested to hear what my family thinks I do with it, you know?
Yeah. When your default takes you to shame, you know, shame, I think, you know, oversimplistically, is that emotion we feel when we're thinking I'm not enough or I didn't do enough or I didn't, you know.
I'm a fraud.
Yeah, it's me. It's me. Something's foundationally messed up with me. Is that a new emotion for you? Is that a new place to go? Or like how long in your life story do you feel like, man, that's what I do when disappointment happens?
How long can I remember?
Yeah. Really? Forever? Yeah.
I think we'll get to the Enneagram stuff and talk about that particular personality tool, but it's in me.
Yeah.
That's where it's just naturally your default. It is 100%.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I appreciate that.
And, you know, I think part of it is I think we all have certain images we want to construct. And the thought of tearing down those images is terrifying sometimes.
Yeah.
For me, I think it's competency.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be competent.
Right.
You know, and thought of as competent. Yeah. And I was an athlete in a former life. And man, when you talk about rear view, I would have to get one of those big rear views like my father-in-law used to have. It was like this panel on the back of his car. You couldn't even see out the mirror. It was so big. It was great. But I mean, you could literally see the entire freeway behind you. But that would have to be the rear view mirror I would look back to find how long ago I was an athlete. So I can't hang my hat on that anymore. You know, am I good at my business some years?
Yeah.
Or I just, you know, fall bass backwards into some of it. Yes, some years. So it's hard to, I think as you get older, one of the things it's hard for me to find is where am I competent? Because in one sense, when you look back, you can look at things you've accomplished.
Yep.
But as time goes and you look back, there's also like, wow, that wasn't great, you know, or I just got lucky.
Yeah.
You know?
You're right.
And so I think it's kind of like there's more information when you look back as you get older.
Yeah.
So there's more things to fear.
Yep.
There's more of a realization of, hey, I am pretty good at this. And man, that was just God's hand that went well at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so.
Yeah. It's so funny in this conversation. I'm thinking of my dad again. You know, I know I've mentioned him before, but I think my wiring, we'll get, like you say, we'll get to Enneagram later. My wiring is so much accomplish, perform, do it right, do it well. There's a better way to do it. You know, I mean, I sound like a one sometimes. I'm more of a three, but it's that I want to be efficient, I want to be effective, and I want to look good. I want you to think I've done it right or done it really well. You know, I wish I had more of my dad in me.
Which would be what?
My father had this ability. I have very few memories of him ever being super frustrated about how something turned out.
Really?
Yeah. And on the one hand, it's easy for me to go, gosh, he was terrified to ever feel sad or disappointed, so he just stayed in his little everything's okay la-la world.
Right.
I'm not sure that's true, though. I think there was this part of him that learned something in life, and maybe, you know, he was born right around the time the Great Depression began. You know, I mean, that we've always said he was the cause of it, but, you know, but I think there was something about him that I think he just had this mentality that, yeah, I'm not entitled to anything in this life, and some things work really well and some things don't work well. And so, you know, when a tool doesn't work for me, you know, I remember using his little, you know, handheld tractor in his little garden once for him. And, you know, if he would run out of grass, I'd throw the thing over and be angry and mad at it, you know? And if one of the tines fell off the dadgum tractor, I think my dad would probably go, well, I'm going to have to go to the hardware store and buy a new one. I mean,
yeah, right.
He just had that even keeled, that things go really well one minute, they hit the fan the next minute and it all falls apart, but that's okay. We just kind of keep moving forward. And I think that's a perspective in our need for efficiency and effectiveness and accomplishments and productivity, that an interruption really disrupts us tremendously.
I remember a few, probably 2 weeks ago, my kids for Christmas got me this little band, this Whoop band.
I've heard about these, yeah.
Yeah, so just all this data, monitors, you know, heart rate, sleep, exercise, all these things. Well, I can nerd out on that stuff.
Yeah.
Not that I do them all, but I like that.
Enjoy it.
Yep. I do it. Well, they gave me this one and then a separate band. So you can change out the bands, interchangeable. Mm-hmm. This should take 30 seconds. I could not figure out how to change this band. And when I say there's one clasp, that's all it is.
Yeah.
And I changed it twice, three times, the wrong way, upside down. And the tirade of foul language that came out of my mouth was so bad. It had gone to that point of, it wasn't just this came out. It was just a tirade. It was so bad that it made my wife laugh.
Yeah.
You know, like, she's like, what is going on? And, you know, but the response ratio was way off.
Yeah,
you know, relative to the problem.
Yeah,
but it's that incompetency. Yeah. I can't even do this. Yeah. You know, and when that you know, I would love to respond like Ray and just say, man, I just gotta. Yeah, here, Jen, you figured this out, or you know, or exactly. Just go leave and come back. But it's like, man, when my incompetency is exposed.
Mm-hmm.
But who's competent all the time?
I know. The expectation, you know, of perfection is so dangerous.
Yeah.
I remember the phrase that I've heard in so many different ways from so many different people through the years, but it's something like this: when my reaction in a moment is disproportionately large to the situation, something has gotten triggered in me and I'm back 30, 40, 50 years ago. I'm back as a little boy. And gosh, I mean, even as you describe that, and it's funny, that story you're telling, literally yesterday, my daughter-in-law came over, and I have an old Fitbit, and she was wanting one to track some steps and stuff. And I said, here, you can have mine. And I gave it to her, and I just was, I had it in the box, of course, I'll put back up like it new. And I said, here, let me show you. You can get a smaller band. My wrist is bigger than yours. Let me show you. These bands come off super easy. And Steve, the love of everything holy, I couldn't get that band off.
Turn the sound off for a minute, and I'll tell you about those bands.
Yeah. You know, but it was the exact same story. And I found myself, because I was with all my family, and again, this is about my image, I was able to laugh at myself. But even as I laughed at myself, I thought, ooh, I like that.
Yeah, right.
I like that. That's what I like. That it's somewhere in me. But had I been home by myself, or had it just been Laura and I would have dog cussed that dadgum Fitbit because the band wasn't coming off the way it was supposed to, right?
I mean,
instead of being able to go, life doesn't work sometimes.
But I think, you know, when you have those moments, I think I've learned now to think, man, what does that say?
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. It says something about me and expectation, and it was way disproportional to the event. And
well, kind of back to our opening question in some ways, you know, today when we were talking about, you know, this, the generation behind us and what they will battle with versus what we did. And I don't know if I can name it, but I think one of the things that I see in my kids, your kids, and other, I think of Joe and Lori, our good friends, who their kids, is there's an overall, a general, it seems to me, maybe I'm not seeing it accurately, but a general acceptance that some things don't go okay from them. It's a little more than with me. I just feel like it was such a performance you've got to accomplish and achieve world that we were raised in. And there are moments when I'll see one of my kids be disappointed with something. And it's not that they're non-reactive, but several of my kids aren't nearly as reactive as I get in those moments. And I just think, gosh, there's something good that they're learning about life doesn't work sometimes.
Right. I do think they're better at processing that. Mm-hmm. And they're more in touch with, you know, it probably took me in my 50s before I would look at an event like that with the band and go, man, what does that say? Yeah. What's going on with me right now that I react like an idiot, you know, which is one of the things I called myself with some other adjectives attached to that. So what's that about, you know? And I think they would do that in their 20s. And I don't think they have the need for, they're more relaxed about some things, about more things than we were relaxed about.
You know, as you said that, I thought of the word limitations. I think they're more aware of the things they don't do well, and they're okay with that, where I felt like I was supposed to know how to figure it out or be able to do anything, you know?
Yeah.
And there's something super, super refreshing in being able to go, oh, I don't know how to fix this. I need to call someone to fix it.
Right.
Where for me, I was like, no, I need to figure it out. And some of that was me, I know, but yeah.
Yeah. I was just thinking about the next generation. And one of the things I saw a lot when I was did some volunteer coaching for a while locally. And one of the things that was interesting about the kids that came through at the high school level is, as I just said this, it made me think about it. A lot of parents came to me and said, hey, man, my kid's not competitive.
Mm.
I got that a lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes it's age, puberty, but sometimes it was just, not sure the drive for this generation is quite what it was in ours. Mm-hmm. So I don't think in terms of competition, I think they were exposed to so many things that maybe that there's just more of a relaxed attitude about things in general.
Yeah.
However, the flip side of that is
that's a good point.
They did not. I got this a lot too. Coach, I don't know where I'm going to go to college. I need to figure that out. I need to figure out what my major is because that's going to be my job.
Yeah.
Like this plan.
At 15 or 16 years old.
Right. And that your major has to be your job and that your job's got to be that your job forever.
Yeah.
Like this plan, this linear plan that has to be in place. And I thought, man, we didn't really have that burden. I mean, it was kind of, you know, if you're going to college, go try to get your degree and go get a job, start paying for your stuff.
Right.
You know, and figure it out.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think with the more relaxed attitude also comes, interestingly enough, this desire for, you know, kind of a certainty sometimes.
Yeah.
And plans.
Yeah. We were walking out of church yesterday, and the pastor had said something about, you know, he's probably mid-50s. He said something about, you know, when he was a kid, he was free to go outside and run around all day and just be home by dinner time and, you know, the alarm clock to be home was when the street lights came on. You know, it's just a free time. He goes, and now it's just so different. You know, our kids are afraid to go outside by themselves. They needed a, and we were walking out, and one of my sons, he said, Dad, that was an interesting point. And he quoted that point. And he said, you know, the reality is, he goes, is that the kid's fault or is that the parent's fault?
Yeah, right.
That's like, exactly.
Right.
Exactly. You know, I think our parents just kind of threw us out and said, go, there's the outdoors, go play in it. And sometimes I think in this generation, this world we're in right now, it's really easy to keep our kids inside or to not push them out the door.
Live 360.
Yeah. Yeah. Or we're tracking.
Which is, and there's, you know, I'm
upsides and downsides.
I'm a dad, right? You know, I'm like, oh, I feel better knowing kind of where, but you know,
yeah.
our parents didn't know where we were all day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No.
And the expectation was different.
Very different. Very so. Different.
Enneagram at some point?
Well, I think we should. Yeah, it'd be good. It'd be good even just to, for you and I know we've kicked around some, it'd be fun to kick around even more. We haven't talked about in a, gosh, several months. It'd be fun to talk about again.
Yeah.
We'll do that soon.
Okay.
All right.
What else today?
Nothing else on my brain.
Yeah.
Good question. I'm glad you brought it.
Yeah. I was just thinking about it yesterday. There's always some battle. Each generation has their battle with, you know, life, spirituality, how those things connect. And, good diving into it with you.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll do it again.
Yep. All right, man.
Out.
Thanks.